Welcome to The Point. I'm Steve Junker in for Mindy Todd. Spring is upon us, and that means anglers everywhere are looking at the water and thinking about fishing. Today, we're talking recreational saltwater fishing, the science, the sport, the superstitions, the secrets. Joining us from the state is Dave Martins, coordinator of the Marine Recreational Information Program at the Division of Marine Fisheries. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
And also in the studio with us is Janet Massinio, former president of the Martha's Vineyard Surfcasters Association and author of the forthcoming book, Casting Into the Light. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Steve.
And also in the studio here, we have Kevin Blinkoff, executive editor at On the Water magazine. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you, Steve.
And on the phone with us is Nelson Siegelman, fisherman and author. His latest book is Martha's Vineyard Fish Tales, How to Catch Fish, Rake Clams, and Jig Squid, with entertaining tales about the sometimes crazy pursuit of fish. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning.
Before we get to the conversation, we also want to hear from you. Are you an angler getting excited about another fishing season? What do you look for as the first moment of the fishing season, launching the boat, catching your first schoolie? What makes you passionate about fishing, and what do you want to know? You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. You can also send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. So I thought we'd start with an overview here. It's kind of a big picture of recreational fishing and what it means to the state and a little bit about how it's managed. Dave, let's begin with you. First, explain your title for us, coordinator of the Marine Recreational Information Program. What do you do?
Sure. Yeah. So my main function is to coordinate the recreational fishing survey. And the whole goal of that survey is to estimate how many fish are being caught by recreational anglers in the state. So we cover the entire state from the New Hampshire border all the way to the Rhode Island border, all of Cape Cod, both islands. And essentially what we're doing is we're going out into the field. We have a staff of about 20 field biologists stationed throughout the state. And we go out into the field to, boat ramps, piers, fishing jetties, beaches. And we simply interview anglers, survey them, and ask them how many fish they caught and threw back so we can get an estimate of their catch that way. And we also identify, count, measure, and weigh marine fish species that they're harvesting. And then all that information is used by fisheries managers and fisheries scientists to manage our recreational fisheries in the state of Mass.
So this is a voluntary survey that you find anglers fishing and you start asking them questions.
Correct.
Give us a sense, how big an industry is recreational fishing in the state?
Oh, it's very big. It's very important to the state of Mass, both historically, culturally, socially, economically. Each year we issue approximately 187,000 saltwater fishing licenses in the state. So that's for shore and private boat anglers combined. And there's another 800 or so charter fishing vessels permitted in the state. And another, 40 some odd party boats or head boats that operate throughout the state. So places like, Hyannis Harbor, Plymouth, Mass, Harwich on the Cape as well, so Seward Harbor, Provincetown, there's head boats in all those different locations where, and the charter fleet and the party boat or head boat fleet are essentially what we refer to as for hire fisheries, where anglers basically hire the boat out or hire the captain to take them out fishing, longer distances offshore to give them access to fish that and sport that they love and enjoy.
I guess the impact to the state is not only on the direct impact of people going fishing or hiring charter boats, but also coming here just to vacation because the recreational fishing is so great.
That's right. It's a big tourism draw. So economically, our recreational fisheries are valued at about $1.2 billion per year. So on an annual basis, that's how much revenue is generated from recreational fishing. And, that revenue is coming from things like, boat purchases, engine purchases, tackle, bait, rods and reels, spending fuel to get to your fishing location. All those expenses combined add up to about $1.2 billion, and that's an astounding figure. But of those $1.2 billion, about $200 million is generated from non-residents, so people from out of state coming to Massachusetts specifically to fish and enjoy our, very rich fisheries and natural resources that we have here. It's quite unique compared to other states. And, you know, that's why people love coming to fish here, because we're so rich in fisheries resources, as most people know.
Kevin, I want to give folks a sense of the scale of the recreational fishery from a species standpoint. And off the top of your head, what are some of the species that we're talking about here that people typically associate with our Cape and Islands fishing?
Well, the Cape and Islands, we're in an interesting place where we're kind of a border between a southern fishery and a northern fishery. We've got cold water to the north and warm water to the south. And so we get a really great mix of species. The main species around here is definitely the striped bass. Bluefish is another very important recreational fishery. We also have tunas, bluefin tuna, very important. Also, folks go further offshore, get into yellowfin tuna, big eye tuna. And then we have bottom fish species. So these are mostly fish that you fish for on the bottom. That includes fluke, scup, black sea bass, which has become very important, and then also ground fish like cod and haddock. So really a wide range.
There's a lot going on.
A lot going on, a lot of options.
Fish are regulated. They have catch limits. Dave, what data is used to set catch limits and sizes for recreational fishing?
Right. So all the data used by stock assessment scientists to gauge how our fish populations are doing, in other words, are fish populations increasing, are fish populations decreasing, or are they staying the same based on how much fishing took place, either recreational fishing or commercial fishing. And you actually need to combine those two, the quantity of fish caught by recreational fishermen and by commercial fishermen. Plus, you need to look at natural mortality, immigration in and out. So all that data is what's used to manage our fisheries. But that's why our recreational fishing survey is so important. It's really important for us to get that estimate of recreational catch correct, so that way our science and management can be correct. So fisheries managers take that data, and that's how they determine what the appropriate season length should be for our different fish species, what should the appropriate minimum size be, and what should the appropriate daily catch limit be for all our different species, so that fisheries are sustainable, so that we don't overfish, and so that, you know, there's fish next year for us to continue with the fishery. Because the worst thing you'd want to do is overcatch in one given year and then not have enough fish in the next year. That's the whole goal of fisheries management and science, is to make things sustainable so that way fishermen and anglers can enjoy fishing in our state.
Janet, you're a vineyard angler, but even saying that suggests that it's maybe just one type of fishing, when fishing really is so different depending on which shoreline you're going to, what time of day it is. Give us a sense of some of the places you head to, a sense of the place of fishing for you.
You mean on the vineyard?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. The beauty of the vineyard is that it's an island. And so we have a south shore and a north shore. We have pond. We have some great ponds, which when they become open to the ocean, become really fabulous places to fish, you know, as they open the pond and all the bait and crabs and every, you know, all that nutrient starts flowing out into the ocean and the big fish come in to feed. You know, on the south shore, we have more of a surf and deep water. And on the north shore, big boulders, you know, where bait hides and big fish come in to feed, and it's a little bit more calm. We have places like Lobsterville, which is fairly flat water, very popular for fly fishermen. And we have a prevailing southwest wind. So places like Lobsterville, on a prevailing southwest wind, it's perfect for fly fishing because you have the wind over your left shoulder. You know, and that's the beauty of the island. You know, I can never find a time when I can't fish, because I can always just move around the island. You know, we have jetties and bridges, and, you know, it's I've been fishing for 42 years, and I'm still busy.
It is one of the wonderful things about fishing that it gets you out to all these different places, and not just to one place, but again, like you say, you're moving around, following the fish, following your nose for what maybe you're looking for as you're going
Absolutely.
Out fishing.
And, you know, just, you know, if it wasn't for fishing, I probably wouldn't be seeing so many sunrises or sunsets. You know, it gets me out there just enjoying the beach. So, you know, for me, it's not only about catching fish. You know, it's about getting out and enjoying nature.
Nelson, I know you've got a skiff you like to fish from. Is that in the water yet? And when do you aim to have it in by each year?
Well, I have an 18-foot, it's called a Tashmu. And in fact, it was built on the island by two brothers who went into business temporarily until they fought and then were out of business. But I'd like to keep it on a trailer because, in a way, just as Janet said, you always have different options when you live on an island. Depending on the weather, I might launch my boat in the in Vineyard Haven Harbor, or I might launch it in Oak Bluffs, or on occasion, if I want to dodge the moped riders and the bicyclists and the walkers, I'll trailer it all the way up to Aquinnah and launch it at West Basin. So I like to keep it in my driveway. It's easier to keep track of that way. But, you know, I'll be launching it soon because the squid will be in what we call middle ground, which is a sort of spine of land that runs right up along in Vineyard Sound. It's really quite an amazing stretch of water because the depth goes from about 45 feet to about 8 feet right in the middle of the sound. And when the current is running over that, you have squid often in that and lots of other bait fish, and it attracts striped bass, bluefish. Later in the season, we'll have bonito and false albacore there. I mean, it's a place that you have to pick your days. As, you know, one of the things I'm careful about is boating safety. In my career at the newspaper, I wrote too many stories about people who had made errors in judgment or just, you know, accidents happen quickly. So I really try to be careful about going out in my boat if there's any question of rough water.
So talking about different places that folks go fishing, Kevin, I know that you're a shore fisherman, but you also kayak fish a lot.
I do, and it's very similar to what Nelson was saying about having a skiff, living on Cape Cod, having access to go different places to get out of the wind or to be where the bite is. That's really one of the best things about having a kayak and kayak fishing. It's on top of your car, and you can go to where the fish are. Another great thing about kayak fishing is, like what Janet was saying, how it puts you in a position where you really get to interact and you're closer to what's going on. That's one of the best parts about fishing. So when I'm out in a kayak, there's no engine. It's very quiet. I'm right close to the water, so you're observing what's happening more. And that's really one of my favorite things about kayak fishing. Feel like you're more part of what's going on around you.
We are talking recreational fishing this hour with Dave Martins of the Division of Marine Fisheries, with Kevin Blinkoff of On the Water magazine, and with fishing authors Janet Massinio and Nelson Siegelman. You can join our conversation at 866-999-4626 or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker, talking recreational fishing this hour with Dave Martins of the Division of Marine Fisheries, with Kevin Blinkoff of On the Water magazine, and with fishing authors Janet Massinio and Nelson Siegelman. We'd love to hear from you. Do you fish the Cape Cod Canal? And have you noticed a change there over the years? Do you have someone special who introduced you to fishing? Give us a call. Let us hear from you at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about one fish, and it's probably the iconic fish for our waters, the striped bass. These fish show up in the spring. Kevin, tell us a little bit about where they come from and how they make their way up the coast.
Sure. Striped bass, like you said, the iconic fish of the Northeast and especially of Cape Cod, they leave our waters in the winter and head south and spend the winter down off North Carolina, Virginia, and that area. And then in the spring, they spawn. So all the mature fish, the bigger striped bass, they move into fresh waters in the Chesapeake Bay area, in the Delaware River, and also Hudson River. So that's actually happening late April, early May, and that's where the big fish are at this moment. The smaller, immature striped bass, they're not bothered with spawning, so they head up the coast and get to Cape Cod first. And so that's what this time of year is. It's schoolie season. It's time to catch the small striped bass while we wait for the bigger ones to arrive.
Just the idea that fish migrate, I think for a lot of people who don't fish and aren't familiar, it's kind of a novel idea. People don't necessarily think about fish moving up and down the coast. Mm-hmm. But a big part of fishing is thinking about when the fish that you're looking for are going to be there. So the striped bass, obviously a valuable fishery for the state. All the states along the East Coast want a piece of it. What are some of the complexities, Dave, of managing fish who don't remain in our waters all year?
Yeah, so one of the ways we've designed the survey, or the way NOAA Fisheries has designed the survey, is that each state up and down the coast conducts the survey the same way for precisely the reason that you bring up, because fish are migratory and they migrate up and down, and they're caught in each state as they're migrating north to south in spring. As Kevin said, they arrive, the striped bass arrive here in spring, but then as the waters begin to cool down in the fall, they migrate back out after feeding here all summer and return to southern warmer waters where they're getting ready to go spawn in the regions that Kevin mentioned. So for that reason, you know, every state up and down the coast is conducting the survey the same way, and that allows us to combine the data sets from each state so you can figure out what's the total catch or total removal of striped bass from the population in every state.
And as you were saying, for most of these fish species, it's not just recreational fishing, there's commercial fishing too. So you're combining the commercial and the recreational numbers to figure out what that impact is.
That's right. And the interesting thing with striped bass is a majority of the striped bass catch is from recreational fisheries, and it's less from commercial fisheries. It's about 75% commercial, 75% recreational versus 25% commercial catch.
I want to bring up the fact that size limits are different for all the different states up and down the East Coast for striped bass. Mm-hmm. So the catch limit for right now for Massachusetts is what?
It's one fish per day at 28 inches.
But it's different if you're in New Jersey, and it's different if you're in Maryland. I don't expect you to know what they are, but that's right.
At the moment, it's a coastwide one at 28 inches.
Oh, is that right?
It is.
Oh, so this is what they're proposing, though, is to change?
So the way it works now, and I believe, is it's one at 28 inches coastwide for anyone fishing on the ocean. There are different sizes in Chesapeake Bay where the water warms up quickly. The big fish leave and they have more of a small fish fishery. So they are allowed through the summer to catch smaller fish. New Jersey does have a small difference there where they have some bonus tags that they give out. But for the most part, at this moment, it's one at 28 inches up and down the coast.
Good. I'm glad I asked. Mm-hmm. Explain a little bit about how these regulations are enforced then. So there's one at 28 inches is the limit. How are the regulations enforced?
Correct. So those limits are enforced by, in our state, by the Massachusetts Environmental Police. So that's separate from what the Mass Division of Marine Fisheries does. The Mass Division of Marine Fisheries, and through our survey is strictly a scientific and management survey, has nothing to do with enforcement. So the enforcement role falls on the Mass Environmental Police. They're the ones who are trained in enforcement. They're the ones who issue tickets. And our survey is strictly, scientific to generate the estimates of catch and look at what the angler's catch rates are and the size composition of the fish being caught, because that tells us, you know, is the population made up mostly of juveniles, adults, have they spawned already or not, what's the age of the fish, all that sort of thing. But the enforcement responsibilities falls on the Mass Environmental Police, and we really appreciate their help in making sure that anglers are staying within the limits, because we've set those prescribed limits for a reason, and the reason is so that the fishery can be sustainable from year to year, because like we said, it's so important to our state, you know, economically and so on, and to so many people. So if you're not harvesting in a controlled manner at one fish at 28 inches or above per day, then that you're going to be at the risk of overfishing. Oftentimes anglers feel like, okay, the regulations are punishing me, I'm not allowed to catch fish and so on. And it's regulations are not to punish anglers. Regulations are in place to keep the fishery sustainable, to protect it so it keeps going, because it's so important to all of us. So, you know, we really appreciate the Mass Environmental Police and their assistance with enforcing these regs at places like the Cape Cod Canal and so on.
The stock of striped bass has fluctuated over the years. And I want to ask you, Janet, and Nelson, too. But let me start with you, Janet. As a longtime angler, what's been your view of the stock of striped bass? Like, you've been fishing this a long time. You've seen them come and go in terms of numbers.
Yeah. I started back in the 70s. And it was a different fishery back in those times. You know,
in what way?
Well, one of the things, you know, we kept everything. You know, there was no such word as a keeper. You didn't have to have a commercial license to sell fish. So, you know, we all subsidized our working during the day, going out at night, and selling our catch to subsidize our income. And, you know, then in the early 80s, things changed. You had to have a commercial license. And, you know, we didn't think that we were doing any harm back in those days. And, of course, whenever we left home, there was always a chance of getting a 50-pound striped bass. Mm. There was many huge breeders back in those days, because we didn't call them breeders. You know, they were lunkers, you know. So, you know, there was always a chance of catching a very large fish. Now, you know, it's obvious that the fish have been in decline. And, of course, you know, I'm also on the Martha's Vineyard Striped Bass Bluefish Derby. In 1984, I was lucky enough to take second in the Derby with a 45-pounder, and my fishing buddy caught a 48.75 and won the Derby. And that was the last year that the striped bass was in the Derby, and we had a 9-year moratorium. So we had a striped bass derby with no striped bass for the next 9 years.
So that was from 1985?
1985 until 1993. Mm. Of course, we still had, at that time, we had weak fish, but then that didn't last very long. I think in 87, the weak fish disappeared. The false albacore became more abundant in our waters, and the bonita, we still have bonita and false albacore. And bluefish, of course, we had bluefish. You know, I've even noticed a decline in the bluefish the last few years. But as I have researched in history, there's times when bluefish become very abundant, and then there's times when they seem to disappear. When they started the Derby in 1946, they didn't even have bluefish in the Derby. And they decided, bluefish started to show up in 1948, and so they introduced them into the Derby, and a 4-pound I think 4-pound, 5-ounce bluefish won the Derby, you know. So, you know, it's a mystery to me. Sometimes these fish are cyclical, and then, of course, you know, I think the herring, you know, the disappearing of the herring has played a big part. You know, in my taxidermy business, a 50-inch fish used to weigh at least 50 pounds. I started a taxidermy business in 1987. And I specialized in skin mounts, so I had my hands on these fish. And then by the mid-90s, I was seeing fish that were 48 to 50 inches long that only weighed 36 pounds. You know, they were emaciated. So you could see that they didn't have the food, you know. So, you know, we've disrupted the ecosystem and the food chain.
Nelson, you also are a longtime fisherman. What's your view of this been as you've been fishing over the years?
Well, it's always frightening to begin talking about the good old days because you immediately start sounding like some old person, you know, telling somebody about how they used to walk to school. But it used to be that when people would ask me when the best time was to come to the vineyard, I would tell them in June, and I'd tell them to go up to Lobsterville Beach, if we just use that as a marker. It was a really consistent place to catch striped bass on the fly rod. Just through the 90s, you would see, God, it would be hard to find a place on the beach. I know that sounds like an exaggeration, but I would literally walk past people looking for a sort of good space that I could step into, and you'd be hearing fish popping up and down the beach. And often you'd know a lot of the people. It was really a sort of fun gathering. And you would regularly catch fish that were probably in the 32-inch, 34-inch, 36-inch range, and every now and then a larger fish. That just doesn't happen anymore. I mean, Lobsterville still produces, is still a great fishery in June and sometimes into early July, but the consistency isn't there. The size of the fish has just changed. So I think anyone that's been fishing regularly around the Cape and the islands has been watching this decline, both in the quantity of striped bass and in the size. And one of the things that often disturbs me about fisheries management is that it, you know, and I understand the reasons, but it often lags behind what people are saying. I mean, for the past 5 or 6 years, people have been expressing concerns about the striped bass population. And now, just now, we're hearing about measures that will reduce the take, and this includes some talk about going up in the size limits and also talk about circle hooks and other methods that will reduce release mortality. But we've certainly seen that decline. Now, having said that, yesterday I went out and fish with a friend, and we were catching lots of schoolies, probably 18-inch, 19-inch fish that were feeding on cinder worms, which was a lot of fun. So I don't want to paint too bleak a picture. There are still fish out there, but certainly it would be nice if we could have all of this mesh, the reports of fishery and fisheries management.
Kevin, at On the Water magazine, it's kind of it serves as a community for a lot of anglers who are just passionate about striped bass fishing, and there's a lot of discussion about limits and how the fish are managed. Tell us a little bit about where this is looks like it's going right now in terms of trying to protect the striped bass so that the species can rebuild.
Mm-hmm. It's a real challenge for fishery managers to try and make everyone happy. And we were mentioning that striped bass are in states up and down the coast. All of those states have to get together and come to some agreements on how they want to manage it. And you have states down to the south that are more focused on harvesting striped bass as a food fish, perhaps. And then you have states up here in the Northeast, like Massachusetts, that depend on striped bass more, are more reliant on a catch-and-release fishery, on an abundance of fish to get tourists to come, to get people to go and actually fish for them. So that's the challenge. Right now where we're at with striped bass, like Nelson was saying, we've seen a decline for the past few years, at least, and it's gotten to the point where striped bass are considered overfished. So next year, managers are planning to create some regulations that reduce the take. It's looking like the minimum size for striped bass will have to increase. The number that they've suggested so far, this is just preliminary, is it would go to one fish at 35 inches as a minimum. So that's one possibility just to give people an idea of what kind of changes are coming.
Dave, I'm wondering from the state side how you manage all this, how you figure out what the limit is going to be. And sometimes you hear people talking about slot limits, which is it has to be bigger than this, but not as big as that, to bring it home as a keeper. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so a slot limit is one of the options being considered. We were just having discussions about this yesterday, but like Kevin mentioned, all the different states need to get together as a group and have group meetings, review the data most importantly, because all the decisions are based on the survey data, look at what the, you know, the size patterns of the catch has been in the recreational fishery, and then try to figure out at what change in size would allow us to have more spawning stock of fish, which is that group of fish that are specific age and a specific size that contribute to reproduction. So our goal is to have more fish reproducing that's going to rebuild the population back to levels that are more sustainable, so we see more abundance of fish. So as far as slot limit options, I think they're talking about having a slot limit of between 31 and 40 inches. So in other words, the fish would have to be a minimum of 31 inches to keep it in the future. And then any fish over 40 inches, you'd have to release it so that it contributes back to the population in reproduction. But all that is preliminary. I'm just letting listeners know these are some of the discussions that's happening. I mean, you know, don't hold us to these specific measurements, but those are some of the options, and that's how a slot limit works. So, you know, you release a certain number of fish up to that minimum size, and you can keep them within that slot, and then anything bigger than that, you have to release it. They will be having meetings in September down at the Mid-Atlantic or the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission that all the states belong to as like an umbrella organization to work through these fishing management issues. So meetings in September and probably a decision coming in October that will go into effect for the following fishing year.
Janet, in your book, you say that it can take a lifetime to become a proficient striped bass fisherman. Yeah. What does that mean?
Well, you know, I think there's just so many, it's just so many little nuances to actually, you know, catching a striped bass. I mean, you know, I've seen guys that come to Martha's Vineyard and I think I have a story in my book, this, you know, August, which isn't a great time to catch a striped bass, and they lob in a lure and they come up with a 50-pounder. You know, that happened. And this guy looks at it and he says, "Oh, what's that?" And he's like, "Oh, my God, that's a striped bass, and that's the fish that most fishermen spend a lifetime looking for." But, you know, really, you know, there are a lot of nuances to catching a fish, you know. I don't know. You know, the longer I fish, the more I see. The only way to catch a fish is to keep my line in the water. You never know. You never know what's going to happen.
We're talking recreational fishing this hour with Dave Martins of the Division of Marine Fisheries, with Kevin Blinkoff of On the Water magazine, and with fishing authors Janet Massinio and Nelson Siegelman. You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626 or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. This is The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking recreational fishing this hour with Dave Martins of the Division of Marine Fisheries, with Kevin Blinkoff of On the Water magazine, and with fishing authors Janet Massinio and Nelson Siegelman. Listeners, have you caught your first schoolie yet? Have you already reserved a fishing charter for later in the season? Give us a call, 866-999-4626. You can join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. I want to talk some fishing superstitions and traditions. Fishermen can be notoriously secretive about their fishing spots. And there's also a self-enforced ethics that goes along with fishing. Each fisherman is individually responsible for obeying the regulations. It's not like someone's looking over your shoulder when you're fishing on an empty beach in the dark. Let's start with superstitions and traditions. Kevin, you have something for us here?
One superstition that I believe in is it's always bad luck to catch a fish on your first cast. And that seems to be a pretty popular one. It seems like a good thing. You get out to a spot, you make that first cast, and oh, the fish are there. But it for some reason, it's a curse. And I can name many times I've gone out, gotten that first fish on the first cast, and your hopes get way up. You think this is going to be a great outing, and then it goes south, and there's not another fish. So that's definitely one of mine.
Janet, you have you mentioned in your book about a lucky sock or not wearing a sock in one foot. that was a minor tradition for you at one point. What kind of traditions do you think about?
Well, it's usually a sweater or a hat or pins. You know, I have a little pin that my son made. He's 30 years old now, but he made it when he was in grammar school, and I like to wear that on my hat. I feel like that gives me good luck. But yeah.
Part of fishing, it seems sometimes as a fisherman, as an angler, so almost arbitrary when things are working or when they're not. And so I'm sure that's part of what reinforces the idea of superstition and traditions. If something happens good, then you try to replicate it by whatever means you can. You keep wearing the pin. You keep wearing the sweater. Nelson, how about you? You have a tradition or a superstition you abide by?
Well, I don't know if it's a tradition, but certainly the saying is don't leave fish. I can't tell you how many times I've left a place where there are fish thinking I'll find bigger fish, only to find no fish and then hear about the big fish that moved into the place where I just left. But, fishermen can be pretty odd, you know, as a group. So there's no telling what will get into somebody's mind. But as I've gotten older and maybe, you know, a bit lazier too, a lot of times I just go fishing to go fishing, and if something happens, great. You know, I take the sort of lightning might strike point of view that particularly when I'm bottom fishing, I'll go someplace day after day and just hope for something to happen. But also there's a bit of the gambling mentality, because if you're fishing a certain spot, now you think, well, if I don't go there tonight, tonight is when the fish are going to move in. This happens particularly during the Martha's Vineyard Striped Bass and Bluefish Derby, so 5 weeks of fishing insanity on Martha's Vineyard in the fall. And it can really become compulsive to the point that you will not miss a night. And I know some people will just go, doesn't matter the weather or their personal responsibilities, and that can become a form of real insanity.
Nelson, you can't see this because you're on the phone, but when you talk about fishing as a gambling mentality, all the fishermen here around the table are smiling. Everybody knows that compulsion and that you're trying to figure out if you should leave the spot or not, and as soon as you leave, you know you've messed things up.
I have pulled out of my driveway and sat there in my car wondering, should I go right or left? And my mind going over every single calculation of bait, wind, what I heard in the tackle shops. But, you mentioned people being secretive and that sort of thing. I have to tell you, the thing that drives me absolutely crazy is, and Janet will attest to this, when I first arrived on the vineyard, I remember finding one place that this wonderful gentleman, Bob Post, who wrote a classic of fishing literature, Reading the Water, Bob showed me how to get to a certain spot where I have seen Janet sitting on a bucket in the middle of the night. I'm walking down the beach, and I see this lonely, dark figure, and there it is, this Janet sitting on a bucket. But at any rate, when I learned how to get there, it was really a secret. I had to go down one of these typical vineyard dirt roads that you can take a left or a right and any number of forks and end up nowhere, or up someone's driveway. Now, someone catches a fish, and the first thing they're doing is sticking it onto their Facebook account or Instagram or wherever. And a few years ago, these Dutch guys that come over to fish the vineyard every year, I asked them how they found a spot that I knew of, and they said they looked it up on Google Maps.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have people in other countries sort of examining the dirt roads from a satellite picture to figure out how to get to places that used to be secretive.
Nelson, you were saying that fishermen can be kind of odd. I feel like fishing, one of the beautiful things about fishing is that it also connects you with a lot of people that you don't normally rub shoulders with. Just going to a place over and over again, or showing up somewhere and starting to fish and starting a conversation. What's your experience been, Kevin, with meeting people through fishing?
Well, it's funny. It sort of matches with what we're talking about with secrecy. There have been times I've gone out surf casting at night, and you'll be fishing next to someone or close to someone, and you don't talk because you don't know who the other person is and if they know about the spot, if they're going to be back. It's almost a competition thing. And there have been many times, and then the sun comes up and you look and you see the person and then realize either you recognize them and you've been fishing near each other all night, or it's someone that you just strike up a friendship with at that point.
We have John on the phone from New Jersey who says he's a frequent visitor to the Cape. John, how are you?
Good. It's Greg, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Very good. Thank you.
Greg.
No worries. Yeah, I just have a question for your experts. What their opinion is of the current seal situation and their impact on striper behavior and numbers?
Good question. Who wants to jump in on that, Dave?
Well, we certainly do hear a lot of comments from anglers that we interviewed during our survey about how seals are disrupting their striped bass fishery, especially when we survey the outer Cape beaches where we find a lot of seals. And another location is out on Great Point on Nantucket. Mm-hmm. So whenever we're surveying at that location, the feedback that we're getting from anglers is that, you know, their striped bass fishing was disrupted by the presence of seals, and they have to constantly move up and down the beach to try to get away from the seals. So it's certainly something that we hear a lot of, but it's quite a conundrum and a dilemma as far as what to do about it. And I'll let some of the other guests comment as well.
Well, they're great bait for white shark fishing. You just need to have really stout tackle.
Well, it depends. I guess also the idea is whose fishery is it? I mean, the seals are out there making their living too.
And it seems like for the most part, striped bass are not so much eaten by seals as they are avoiding areas where seals are found.
Mm.
I think the science for the most part shows that seals feed a lot on the same foods that striped bass feed on. And certainly if they have a chance, if you hook a striped bass near a seal on the beach or something like that, a seal will take it off the line. That happens quite often. So you have this Outer Cape fishery, which for years and years had a lot of tradition, was very important. And as the seal population has expanded, it doesn't really exist anymore. There really isn't that option to go there and fish for striped bass. The striped bass are avoiding the area.
Greg, great question. Thanks for calling.
I
want to talk a little bit about, you were talking about secret spots and people who show you things. And so many of us get into fishing because somebody took the time to tell us a little bit about this. And it's a little bit hard to get into fishing. I was talking to you earlier, Dave, about you were suggesting that maybe there's young people aren't getting into fishing as much as they used to. But the state is trying to run some programs to address that. Tell us about that.
That's correct. Yeah. So based on the licensing data, we're looking at the age of anglers. And we noticed that the age of anglers is increasing, and there's fewer and fewer each year. There's fewer and fewer younger people seeking out their license and participating in fishing. And there's some other data sources that are showing that. And that's of concern to MassDMF and just to the public in general. So we're trying to figure out ways to incentivize young people to get out into the outdoors, pick up a rod, go fishing. So we are now holding annual fishing clinics where we teach young kids how to fish. We provide the fishing rods, so we've invested funds in purchasing fishing rods and holding these clinics at different places in the state throughout the year to get young anglers and their parents to teach them how to fish, teach them how to use a reel and a rod, how to cast, how to put bait on the hook, what size hooks to use, all that sort of knowledge that we learned from, you know, our grandfathers, our fathers, and so on. We're trying to teach kids that so that way they can, you know, begin participating in fishing because it is such a great pastime.
Janet, on the island with the Derby, do you see it skewing older or does it continue to bring young people in?
We're growing every year, and we have a really big, we have mini junior division and a junior division. And, you know, I was doing teaching workshops for about 9 years. It was a 3-hour hands-on. I'd meet people at the beach, and I was amazed at how many island people that had grown up there that never knew how to fish. Well, I shouldn't say I was really amazed because I know how hard it was for me to break into the fishing world. And when I taught fishing, the basics that I taught was first how to tie a knot, because, you know, I lost so many fish on not knowing how to tie a correct knot, and, you know, how to take your reel apart, you know, not to be so afraid of your gear, how to take care of your gear, and you know, all different lures. It's not just one retrieve. Every lure is a little bit different retrieve. How to read a tide chart. And, I geared it towards adults so that they could teach the children. But, yeah, no, I mean, I think we have a growing, you know, many, many children that join the Derby, many juniors. It's great.
Lisa is calling from Harwich. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
What's your question?
I guess one of my questions, I mean, I understand fishing is such a part of the Cape and the islands and has been around a long time. When we talk about sustainability and the fisheries and all that goes on, there's so much that it doesn't seem like is being talked about in the conversation. And I can just express my experience having been on the south side of the Cape after one of these fishing weekends where all these people were down catching and releasing. And the amount of dead fish that I came upon on the beach that were, you know, they're small, so they're not keepers, but I think it was a catch and release program anyways. And there was a ton of dead fish all over the beach. And that's, you know, we talk about overcatching and bycatch and all those sorts of things and the destruction of the food source, but we're also not talking about how the human interaction is also affecting it.
This is a good question. Catch and release is something that we should talk about. Lisa, thanks for that. Dave, talk a little bit about catch and release and some of the, we think of it as a good thing, you're releasing these fish that you catch, but the mortality can be quite high here.
Correct. Yes, so the mortality can be high. We have calculations for what the post-release mortality rate is for different species, and that's affected by things like, you know, air temperature, water temperature, how the fish are handled, how long it was out of the water, but also what type of fishing gear was used. Certain types of hooks are more damaging to fish than other types, so MassDMF is really promoting the use of circle hooks when you're using bait to target fish species, but especially for striped bass, because a hook that's shaped in a circle as opposed to a hook that's shaped in a J, the circle hook will lodge in the fish's mouth where there are hard parts and there's not necessarily vital organs there that are going to lead to mortality. So using circle hooks is a conservation measure and a conservation device that will allow more fish to survive. You're going to increase the post-release survival and then rebuild the population that way. And it is quite significant, as you mentioned, Steve, when you think about how many hundreds of thousands of anglers there are and how many trips they make, that turn the hundreds of thousands of anglers turns into millions of trips and you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of fish released. So whatever we can do to increase the post-release survival is a conservation measure that's going to rebuild the population and be good for our future.
Kevin, the On the Water magazine runs its own Derby, the Striper Cup, throughout the season. This year, catch and release is a bigger part than ever before.
That's right, and that's part of it was what we wanted to show as an example, knowing that striped bass populations have decreased. And another part of it was demand from anglers who fish the tournament. There's a big catch and release ethic out there for striped bass. And most fishermen do not like to see a fish not survive after being released. So a big part of our tournament this year is also education, sharing the same messages that Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries is sharing, how to catch striped bass and release them in a way that they survive. And we're using the Striper Cup tournament as a way to get that message out there.
I want to talk a little bit about people who may want to eat local fish but aren't fishermen, and what they should look for when they head to a fish market, and how they can get access to good fish like that.
Yeah, there's definitely lots of local markets that provide, local fish seafood. So I would seek those places out where our office is located in New Bedford, Mass. And there's lots of really good small seafood markets there that have nice fresh fish. So look for, good red color in the gills, good clear eyes, and you'll know that it's fresh. And, pick up some different cookbooks. On the Water magazine actually produces a really nice cookbook on how to prepare their catch. So.
Well, one of the tricky things is something like striped bass. The commercial season for that, which means the season in which you can buy this at a fish market, is pretty limited, or can be. And it seems like maybe it's gotten a little bit longer at the end.
It has been extended now, so I think it runs from June through until they've caught their quota. So there is greater availability of striped bass in markets. There's also a lot of other local fish that I think people don't realize are local fish and are delicious to eat and are very sustainable. The stocks are doing well. For example, scup. If you can find scup in a local market, that's a local fish that's great to eat. Black sea bass, haddock, another great fish to eat. So there are more local options than people realize. It's a shame when I see people buying imported or farmed seafood from other places and ignoring what we have locally.
It can be tricky. You go into your fish market and everything can look good there, but you have to be careful about, if you're really shopping local, you have to ask where that fish is coming from.
Talk to the fishmonger. That's the best thing you can do.
We have just a minute or two left here. Nelson, are you on the line there?
Yep.
I want to ask
yep.
you about, you said you've already been out fishing a little bit so far. What have you seen?
Well, just people out, and I'll just give you one quick example. The other night when I was fishing, there was a young guy. All of a sudden, he appeared on the shore, and then his friend showed up. And you can hear people talking when it's quiet. And he said, "I just got out of work. This is the best therapy." And I thought, wow, that really says it all. I mean, he was a kid, probably looked like a day laborer, and as happens now. He probably had the fishing rod in the car. He didn't have any fancy waders, just his boots. He just ran down with a handful of lures. And I would say to everybody listening that this whole fishing thing does not have to be a mystery or difficult. I know it's easy on the island, but people can do it on the Cape too. Throw a fishing rod in the car, a handful of lures, a pair of waterproof boots. You don't need to make it a big production. Often I just run down to the closest jetty near me, which is 10 minutes away, and I'll cast for a half an hour after dinner, and that's it. I've just managed to watch the sun go down and relax. So I would encourage everyone just to get out there and don't make it a big production.
Kevin, why do you go fishing?
That is one of the biggest reasons I go fishing. I've described fishing to non-fishermen, and they say that sounds like meditation, what you're describing. Mm-hmm. And that's my favorite part about it, being out somewhere. You clear your mind of anything that's going on, any issues or problems or anything else you're thinking of. And for that amount of time you're out fishing, you're really focused on the natural environment, you're focused on the fish, and you're focused on what's going on in that moment.
Janet, when you go out fishing, what are you looking for?
Yeah, same thing. I just feel like when I get out there, I exhale. And then, of course, I can't even believe after 42 years, when I get a little tug, I get so excited. Last night I went out with a friend and I didn't expect to get a fish. I didn't catch it, but I got a hit. And I was like, oh, my God, I got a hit. It's just exciting. And like everybody else, just to get out there and leave all your responsibilities behind for a few minutes. That's the best thing for me.
And that is our program for today. I want to thank my guest, Dave Martins, coordinator of the Marine Recreational Information Program at the Division of Marine Fisheries. Dave, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And Janet Messinio is a former president of the Martha's Vineyard Surfcasters Association and author of the forthcoming book, Casting Into the Light. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you, Steve.
And Kevin Blinkoff, executive editor at On the Water magazine. Kevin, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And, of course, Nelson Siegelman, fisherman and author. His latest book is Martha's Vineyard Fish Tales, How to Catch Fish, Rake Clams, and Jig Squid, with entertaining tales about the sometimes crazy pursuit of fish. Always had the longest title, Nelson. Thanks for being here. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.